This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Lehigh Regional Medical Center in Lee County plans to launch a new behavioral health unit for patients 55 and older later this year. But even before its completion, the hospital will begin offering electroconvulsive therapy for patients suffering from severe depression and other mental health issues. Later this hour, we'll learn more about the unit and about electroconvulsive therapy from Lehigh Regional's CEO Gary Bell and Dr. Ivan Mazzarana, who is directing the new behavioral health unit. But first, today we enter the eighth week of Florida's annual legislative session, and state and federal lawmakers are under pressure to address gun regulations and school safety after the Valentine's Day mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School that killed 17 people. Survivors of the shooting traveled to Tallahassee last week to speak directly with state lawmakers and to participate in a rally demanding safe schools and an end to gun violence. Then on Friday, Florida House and Senate leadership outlined a $400 to $500 million series of proposals aimed at addressing the problem. Those proposals include a measure that would allow law enforcement-trained school employees to become armed marshals, as President Donald Trump has proposed. They also include raising the minimum age of gun purchasers to 21, banning bump stocks, which allow firearms to rapidly spray bullets, requiring a three-day waiting period for purchasers of all types of firearms, and increased spending for school safety improvements and mental health services. Governor Rick Scott says he supports some of those proposals, but has come out against the idea of arming teachers. Meanwhile, state legislative leaders say they will not be looking to ban semi-automatic rifles known as assault rifles, such as the one used in the Parkland High School shooting, as well as the shootings at Sandy Hook, the Pulse nightclub, and in the Las Vegas shooting. Meanwhile, students and communities throughout the state have been participating in protest walkouts and other demonstrations demanding action to address gun violence. Joining me now for a closer look at these bills, as well as a broader analysis and interpretation of the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, is Florida Gulf Coast University political science professor and Second Amendment expert Dr. Peter Bergerson. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Well, thanks, John. I'm happy to be here.
And later on in the program, we'll be joined by WGCU's own reporter, Rachel Iacovone, who covered last Friday's gun reform rally in Collier County. In the meantime, I invite listeners to join the conversation with your comments and questions. Call 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And Dr. Bergerson, I wanted to turn first to you for some broader analysis of these legislative proposals we just saw come out of Tallahassee on Friday. You know, we know that survivors of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooting met directly with state lawmakers in Tallahassee last Wednesday. Do you think these proposals are really addressing these students' concerns?
Some are, and some aren't. I think that the idea of a waiting period is perhaps a step in the right direction. The idea of having some mental health background checks, increased background checks, is a good idea. The gun stock issue is a good idea. 3-day wait for issuing or licensing all firearms. You know, all of those are steps in the right direction. The idea of arming teachers, though, I just absolutely find that to be horrendous.
Also, you know, Speaker Corcoran has said there's really not going to be any kind of effort regarding a ban on semi-automatic weapons, which has been one of the main talking points for these kids.
Yeah, that is unfortunate, I think. But the the politicians, the legislature, has to walk a thin line between the demand for some regulation, some movement on the issues that we've mentioned, and also appealing to the National Rifle Association, gun groups, those individuals who have a constitutional right. In other words, not only the U.S. Constitution, but Florida's Constitution protects the right of having firearms. It's the extent of the firearms, it's the nature of the firearms, and which ones should be banned and which ones shouldn't be. And there's a obvious disagreement over the use of semi-automatic weapons. These are really Army assault designed for combat situations.
Yeah. You know, and on this issue of NRA support and, you know, the fact that we have an election looming this November, do you think a lot of lawmakers, particularly conservative Republicans, might be rethinking their strategy, given that, you know, a strategy of these new young protesters has been to really point out the connections between lawmakers and the contribution levels they've received in their campaigns from the gun lobby?
Yeah, I agree. I think that this is particularly true, and it's not just so much the campaign contributions, but it's the voting force and strength that they have in communities, particularly in close elections. One of the things that the NRA does very well is that it marshals their members in forms of information and in addition to contributions. And they're a single issue agency or organization, and their members are really fired up about that particular issue. And frankly, oftentimes I think misinformed about what the Constitution allows or not allows.
You know, since lawmakers are now facing pressure to pass this $400 to $500 million legislative package, how do you see this complicating the matter of, you know, just passing a balanced budget by the March 9th deadline when regular session is slated to end? I mean, after all, lawmakers entered session with a projected budget shortfall. And usually at this time, aren't legislative leaders from both parties and conference sort of hammering out the differences? And
absolutely. You know, it would be great to see some things done, but good public policy, lasting public policy, is not going to be made in an 8 or 10 day period. My suggestion, and perhaps maybe the governor or the legislature will look into it, is have a special session.
I haven't heard any talk of that, but do you think that's likely?
Well, I think if you – yes, I think it's a likely one. If the movement and the pressure for action continues – oftentimes in these events that we've had, like we saw on February 14th, that there's an outcry for action and then it dissipates. And subsequently, you know, one of the things that we have to see is how committed, what kind of leadership there is going to be on the side of those people who want to see action, how they want to hold the governor and the state legislature accountable. That will be to determine whether they get something accomplished, seriously accomplished, other than just window dressing.
Governor Rick Scott, of course, is eyeing the Senate. House Speaker Corcoran is eyeing the governor's mansion. Do you think that that's influencing the decisions that they're making in terms of Governor Scott's decision not to support the idea of arming teachers, as House and Senate leadership and even the president have said? And, you know, and then we see Speaker Corcoran, you know, trying to distance himself from political pundits like Dinesh D'Souza, who, even though just weeks ago he introduced him at a meeting here in Naples because of these pretty shocking, mocking comments he's made about the survivors of that shooting.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question that that one of the things that the governor and the state legislature, the Speaker of the House, they're all looking forward to is the primary elections in August, as well as the November election, and particularly for the two top positions on the ballot here in Florida, the U.S. Senate race. Every indication has been given that the governor probably will be a candidate, Republican candidate, as well as the Speaker of the House wanting to be the governor, running for governor. He's already announced. Anyway, and so part of the issue is that I think that one of the reasons that this issue seems to have some legs to it is that, one, it was sad to say in a school, which there's an identifiable group of people there that need protection and have organized. And second, it's a suburban issue where firearms is a real problem. Urban and suburban issues is where the biggest problems with firearms exist. The problems in rural areas, they're just not as as serious as they are when you look at the major metropolitan areas in Florida.
So basically you're saying that because the latest shooting occurred in a public school, yep. this is going to play out differently than, say, what we saw at Pulse nightclub or the outdoor concert in Las Vegas, simply because of the venue.
I think it has the potential. We have to wait and see. But because what happens is that in the Vegas and the nightclub shooting, there wasn't really an identifiable groups of people here. You know, you have education and children at stake, and teachers, and public safety. In other words, it really goes to the heart of the role and function of government of having order and protecting the people.
Well, let's take a look specifically at the Second Amendment here, because that seems to be, interpretations of the Second Amendment seem to be foundationally at the heart of this matter and where people, sort of make their own decisions about where they stand on this polarizing and really passionate issue. First of all, what sparked your interest in kind of, focusing in on this particular issue in the first place?
Oh, I guess I've had a longstanding, maybe 30-year interest in reading the research and law journal articles about the Second Amendment and what does it mean and how has it been interpreted and what the literature has said. The Second Amendment is very brief, 20-25 words. It talks about having a well-regulated militia.
Yes.
At least the arguments or the discussion regarding the Second Amendment is this a collective right designed for the militia, or is it an individual right that's designed for self-protection and be able to defend yourself? And in the 1930s, the U.S. Supreme Court defined the Second Amendment as one that was for a well-regulated militia. And then two recent Supreme Court cases that came up, one in the District of Columbia and the other in the city of Chicago. And in the District of Columbia case, which is also known as the Heller case, the Supreme Court and Justice Scalia wrote the 5-4 decision, said that individual Americans do have a right to own firearms. And he argued that the Second Amendment should be interpreted the way the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution. In other words, he was one of the he was an originalist and was one of the first to argue that the Constitution should be interpreted as it was originally written. Well, when the Constitution was originally written, he argues that the right to keep and bear arms was that you could have firearms in your home for self-protection. And so there has been, always debate and discussion about what does the Constitution mean, and now the Supreme Court has argued that you have an individual right to defend yourself. Florida also has a pretty specific provision in their Constitution, and that would be something also that would have to be considered. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to point out that, in Scalia's decision in that 2008, District of Columbia v. Heller case, he specifically wrote that the right to bear arms is, quote, not unlimited.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. I was just going to get that to that exact point, is that if there are guns that are assault-type weapons, these can be regulated. In other words, it's not an unlimited right at all. That he defined it, if it has dangerous and unusual that's the terms that he used in his decision. And so any case that would go to the Supreme Court would have to make a case that that particular firearm was, quote-unquote, dangerous and unusual to be subject to regulation or an outside ban. That's, I mean, an outright ban.
Yeah.
That's a direct quote from his decision.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, one of the questions I was asking myself in preparing for today's interview is why hasn't the U.S. or the U.S. Supreme Court ever taken up specifically this issue of bans on, you know, quote unquote, assault style weapons? And correct me if I'm wrong here, but the answer that I was kind of looking at was saying, well, even though this might be something that's hotly debated around, you know, dinner tables all over the country and on social media, I haven't found a single federal appeals court decision where, you know, the ability to ban certain types of weapons has been held as unconstitutional. That's never happened. So maybe from the U.S. Supreme Court's perspective, looking at the, you know, the context of the federal judicial system, they're saying, well, there might be conflict in society, but not in the decisions the federal judges have actually made.
Yeah. I think that in the 1930s, U.S. Congress banned the use of Tommy guns. Or which were known as Tommy guns, and that statute was upheld. So it's not so much that they addressed assault weapons from a different perspective. And also, it's interesting that out in California, California has had a law that on the books that deals with that may make its way to the Supreme Court. California has a law in the books that requires applicants for firearms to demonstrate, quote unquote, good cause for carrying a weapon, like working in a job that has a security risk associated with it. So this was challenged in the U.S. Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit out in San Francisco upheld the statute. This may go on to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court may hear that. So this may be a route that the court may take to readdress this issue of the California statute.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to deviate from our conversation for just a few minutes here and bring in WGCU's own Rachel Iacovone. She, following the Valentine's Day mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, you know, there was a largely youth-led demonstration just this past Friday in Collier County during which protesters were rallying for gun reform. So let's go ahead and hear that report now, and then we'll hear from Rachel afterwards.
Politicians who sit in their gilded House and Senate seats funded by the NRA telling us nothing could have ever been done to prevent this. We call BS!
Emma Gonzalez unknowingly created a rallying call when she told the crowd on an anti-gun rally in Fort Lauderdale a few days after the shooting at her high school that the students were calling BS. An hour and a half's drive across the state and a week's time later, students in Collier County were saying the same, led by another Emma, 16-year-old Naples High School student Emma Sullivan, who rallied her troops for the We Call BS student-led rally for gun reform.
I was raised in this generation where we see a lot of cruelty, but we are just getting to the age where we see how horrendous it is. And after seeing those students at Parkland, it's our time.
Hundreds gathered outside the Collier County Courthouse in Naples, holding hand-lettered signs that said things like, Congress, porn is more important than a child's life, and mental illness is global, mass shootings are uniquely American. After some students' speeches, the group moved to the busy corner of US 41 and Airport Polling Road.
So we tell them,
we are the children,
we are the children,
the mighty, mighty children,
the mighty, mighty children.
There's a lot of younger kids because it's more focused on, like, us.
That's Marina Coyle. She attends Community School of Naples with 13-year-old Sky Warland.
I don't know the people who personally got killed, but I know people who were friends with them, and they're doing what we're doing right now, so
Skye used to live in Miami. It was through her friends there, the ones who were friends with victims at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, that she first heard the news. She stood beside Marina on the front lines of the march as Marina's father, Cormac Coyle, looked on.
Everybody has a line over which, you know, you cannot sit back and take it anymore. You have to stand up and make your voice heard. And I think we're definitely there.
Hours before the group gathered on Friday, Governor Rick Scott held a news conference where he called for barring people under 21 and the mentally ill from purchasing guns.
That's not going to protect our kids in their classroom. You mean, what's to stop a 21-year-old or a 22-year-old doing the same thing? I mean, that's nonsense to say that that's a solution.
Others weren't as sure, even with the assumed stances of their party affiliation, like the president of the Bonita Springs and Southlake County Democratic Club, Stephen Blumrossen.
It's too complicated an issue for me. I think I'm a pretty smart person, but I can't find a solution. I wrote on Facebook the other day, maybe the children will find a way. And tonight, I really believe it's possible.
As if on cue, the children standing atop the Collier County sign borrowed another line popularized by the students of Marjory Stoneman Douglas. Rachel Iacovone, WGCU News, Naples.
And Rachel Iacovone joins us in studio now. Thank you, Rachel.
Hi, John.
So you've covered a lot of rallies. Tell us what was this one like in comparison?
So actually, in the words of one of the students I talked to, Marina Coyle, that you heard in the story, she had gone to the Women's March in Naples that was in the same area last year. And she said the crowd kind of reminded her of that. So making that comparison, I was at the Women's March on Washington. And of course, that was much bigger. But that kind of crowd the wide range of ages and genders and, you know, the ethnicities that were represented. But this crowd was even younger. If you heard those chants, those were a group of over a dozen, like 8-year-olds holding these signs. So,
and, you know, you've also talked with the president of the Bonita Springs and South Lee County Democratic Club.
Yeah, Stephen Blumrossen. So you heard him at the end. He actually compared the crowd there to the crowd at the DNC.
Oh.
So that was another comparison that was drawn. But he was really interesting because he was very openly admitting that he didn't know the answer to this. And some might assume that as a Democrat, he would immediately be for gun control or even banning all guns. But he said, we should leave that up to the kids.
And you mentioned in your story that very morning, Friday morning, Governor Scott had called for barring the sale of firearms to those under 21 and those with mental illness. Had that news spread to the protesters by that time?
Oh, yeah. All of them knew. I did not talk to a single person who hadn't already heard the news. Most said that they didn't necessarily agree with that. But the event organizer that you heard, Emma Sullivan, she said that she was just happy that he was coming to the table for that kind of conversation. That surprised her.
And, you know, have there been rallies like this in Naples in the past?
Not to my knowledge, no.
So why now?
A lot of people there were saying that after Pulse, they had this kind of guilt. But now that this was a school, and not to say Pulse was different, the kids are the ones who are rising up. So Emma Sullivan said she'd lived with this guilt. And then now that it was a school and it was so close, you know, the other kid that I talked to in there, Sky Warland, she was saying that she actually knew friends of friends. And that was by chance that I spoke with her. And this was a student who was only separated by maybe a couple degrees of separation here. And the school is an hour and a half from Naples. So it was really close to home for these kids.
All right. Well, WGCU's Rachel Iacovone, thanks so much for your insights.
Of course. Thanks, John.
And we are about out of time for this portion of the program, but Dr. Peter Bergerson, Second Amendment expert and FGCU political science professor, is going to continue. That will be available online. You can go to wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live after 2 o'clock this afternoon to hear our conversation in its entirety. We're taking a short break, but when we return, we'll learn about Lehigh Acres Regional Medical Center's plans for a new behavioral health unit for patients 55 and older to open later this year, and the addition of electroconvulsive therapy treatments for patients suffering from severe depression and other mental health issues. I'm John Davis, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. And we're continuing our conversation with FGCU political science professor Dr. Peter Bergerson. Again, this is a portion of the conversation that ran long, but we thought this was a really important discussion to have. So we're having an extended version of that show online. Dr. Bergerson, where we left off, we were highlighting actions that other states have done. You talked about California. What about Illinois?
Yeah. One of the things that nationally has happened is a tension given to firearms, gun control legislation, obviously here in Florida, but other states as well. And we mentioned, or at least I drew the attention to a piece of legislation that has been upheld in the federal courts out in California. But it seems research shows that at least 26 states placed regulations on gun store shops, which would not fall under the Second Amendment. And these would include cameras in the stores so that they would be able to videotape and know who these people are. They would also have background checks on the employees who work in these stores, and that they would stop or prevent, as best they could, straw buyers who were buying the guns and then turning them over to individuals who were criminals or were used in criminal activity. And so we shouldn't just think that we're alone with the concerns that are going on. This is an issue that may really blossom into some public policy decisions.
Yeah. And what you've been highlighting for us here and looking at what Florida is looking to do, what we have done, what other states have done, really all hinges on really interpretations of the Second Amendment and
absolutely
whether or to what extent the right to own a firearm can or cannot be infringed upon. I was wondering if you could maybe give us some broader insight about how the Second Amendment has been interpreted in the past and perhaps how that's changed over the years.
Well, for a long period of time, the Second Amendment was only designed for federal cases, federal law, and almost all of the firearm regulations and rules that governed or didn't govern them was left up to the states. Mentioned in the there were two cases in the 1930s that the federal government entered into the use of regulation of firearms. And there they interpreted the Constitution excuse me, they interpreted the Constitution, the Second Amendment of the Constitution, as firearms were in direct relationship to a well-regulated militia, and that now or then, as we do have now, each state has its own militia or what we would call the National Guard. And subsequently, that lent itself to the ability to regulate firearms. Well, the issue lay dormant for the most part until 2008, when there was the District of Columbia had a very, very strict firearm, individual ownership of firearms. And it was challenged in the federal courts. And this was – and so the federal courts intervened, and they said that the District of Columbia went too far and that individuals had the right to interpret the Scalia court in a 5-4 decision using an originalist argument. In other words, that Scalia and the originalists thought that the Constitution and the meaning of the Constitution should be the same as it was when the Constitution was written. And so his group of justices, they searched for what the Constitution meant when back in, at least in this case, in the 1790s, and then apply that to the present day. And that's how he arrived at this idea that, in essence, overturned what had been established in the 1930s of a well-regulated militia. So in the 30s, it was a collective right that went to the states to have militias, to the Scalia court, in which it now is an individual right, to keep and bear arms in relationship to their personal property, individual self-defense. That is basically where it stands. They're also following the Heller case in D.C. There was a case in Chicago, and there's when the first time that the Chicago also had a very stringent gun control law, and the Supreme Court went even further and has intervened now in state and local gun control legislation, and that's the latest that and that's where the interpretation and the meaning of the Second Amendment stands today.
And what would be your qualified, educated, assessment of this ideology of constitutional originalists when it comes to issues like the Second Amendment? I mean, because one of the things we hear from advocates of more gun control is that the founding fathers who wrote this document were living in a world where the technology that guns are at now, it wasn't the same thing at all.
Well, also when the founding fathers wrote the Constitution, they did not approve it. Remember, the founding fathers only recommended it, and it was really approved by the states. And many of the provisions that were in the Constitution, including the Second Amendment, had never been tried before. So in the ratification of the Second Amendment, each state, in essence, defined what the different provisions in the Constitution meant. So people in New York could define it. The Constitution is open to interpretation and open to meaning. There's no reason necessarily why that should be the standard of the originalist point of view to approve the Constitution. But that is the prevailing thought now on the court. Also, how are you going to really know what the founding fathers actually thought about the provisions in the Constitution, because they didn't vote up and down on each particular each particular provision in the Constitution, they voted it in mass.
Well, I was going to say I wanted to maybe switch gears a little bit and kind of put a spotlight on the organization that keeps coming up in these debates, and that's, of course, the NRA, the National Rifle Association. But they've only been actively lobbying for firearms since about 1975, as I understand it, even though they've been in existence since the late 1800s. Can you give us some insight on that and perhaps what sparked NRA leadership's interest in lobbying?
Well, they increased the lobbying efforts, and frankly, they are really a case study on a lobbying group that has been very successful. One of the reasons that they became very active politically in the 1970s was the efforts by Lyndon Johnson at that time and the government to regulate firearms. And there were actions and decisions. I don't have them right in front of me now, but there were actions and steps that were taken, in fact, legislation that were involved in the 60s involving the regulation of firearms. Small, minor steps, and that's when the NRA then moved in. The National Rifle Association is an organization that it really is supported very heavily by the gun manufacturers, in addition to gun owners.
And, you know, here in Florida, how powerful is the NRA? I mean, I know Marion Hammer has quite a reputation.
Yeah, very powerful. We have seen a number of issues over the last two or three legislative sessions about having firearms on college campuses, conceal and carry, on and on. They the lobbyist that you referenced has a reputation in Tallahassee as being, again, one of the most effective.
Yeah.
And what they have done is to identify those individuals who are in positions of power to able to either promote the issues that they're interested in or defeat those that they're not, that they're opposed to. And, you know, she's been a full-time lobbyist for a number of years, and she knows the levers of power, and they have a very well-organized, a very disciplined get out the vote, the voter identification, and in, again, in elections, the voting power is very important for the National Rifle Association.
Do you think the NRA may be, you know, pardon the pun here, shooting itself in the foot by seeming to double down after events like this mass shooting in Parkland? And by that, I mean we're beginning to see corporations break their ties with the group. Just last week, NRA spokeswoman Dana Lash made some incendiary comments against what she calls legacy media when she spoke at the CPAC convention, addressing the media, you know, on the risers in the back of the room, accusing them of loving mass shootings because it boosts our ratings. And before you respond, Dr. Bergerson, I just want to say that I feel comfortable speaking on behalf of anyone who's ever covered a mass shooting anywhere when I say we'd be thrilled to take a ratings hit if it meant we would no longer have to cover these events and the funerals of children and other victims killed in mass shooting events. Ridiculous, incendiary statement. But
yeah, exactly.
I mean, but is this helping them? Is this appealing to their base?
Yeah, exactly. They have to appeal to their base. And that's what they're doing initially. And they have a track record of these issues of, you know, tend to fade away. We've had at least two other Columbine in the Connecticut shooting, Sandy Hook shooting, and these were horrendous tragedies as well. You know, just a heartbreaking, and nothing came from it. We had a leader of the Republican Party was shot and at a baseball practice, and nothing came of that. So I guess at this stage I want to hold my gunpowder about where, you know, what will come of it from a significant policy. Some, I think, may.
So in the past, following mass shootings, it's been an effective strategy, but with this one, it might just be too soon to say.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. For sure, the reaction is way over the top. That's for sure.
How far can any one state go in advancing gun control?
Well, you know, it partially will depend on their constitution. California, that's a pretty strong move that took place out in California. Based on the Heller decision and based on past decisions, firearm control, you know, it could be very stringent, or it could be – my guess is that you might have some states like, Wyoming, which is very wild and open. They probably have very little, you know, and I don't know, but that would be my guess. Where you have a heavily urban state like California, there's a lot of latitude. The point is there's a lot of latitude. Some of the benchmarks that it would determine that would be the state constitution, the internal dynamics of the state. Obviously, California, the NRA, does not hold the force and power that it does here in Florida.
And, you know, we've been focusing primarily on, you know, Florida lawmakers, but I did mention at the beginning of the show that, of course, federal lawmakers are feeling this pressure to take action as well. What's the climate look like there? I mean, I know I think they're just going back into session this week, so this will be the first opportunity for, any action to be taken. But, I mean, what's the climate like? Is this definitely going to take a bipartisan effort to get anything done?
Oh, for sure. It's going to take we have to have a bipartisan effort to pass anything on the federal level. And at least from my perspective, even here in the state level, I think that there's a need to have a bipartisan effort. That's where you get good policy, lasting policy, that is also going to be supported by the governor, the president, as well as the courts. But in at the federal level, I think that it's less likely to see legislation, partially because of the dysfunction that we find in Washington right now in trying to enact almost any piece of legislation. And in order to pass legislation through the Senate, you would need 60 votes, and you would need at least 8 or 9 Democrats to pass it. And so that's a pretty high standard.
Any final thoughts you want to leave us with, Dr. Bergerson, that we didn't get to?
Well, it's a fantastic area to study, but it's on the other hand, it's a sad that you have to have the tragedy of the school shootings to have an open debate and discussion. But hopefully, something good will come from it.
Well, thanks so much for your time. We've been speaking with Florida Gulf Coast University political scientist, Dr. Peter Bergerson. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
And this is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.